thank you for everyone for tuning in to another episode of the Extra Rounds podcast. As always, my name is Mike Dice.
I'm Aaliyah Sabetha.
And we are here live from Chicago to talk all things MMA with you. First, I wanted to announce that we're going to have Ken Shamrock on the show 30 minutes past the hour. He's going to be calling in to talk about a panel he's doing here in Chicago alongside Frank Shamrock and Guy Metzger. So that's going to be an interesting thing if you're in Chicago. We'll give you details later in the show about how you can attend that. You can meet the guys. You can ask them questions and interact with them. It's a really cool thing that they're doing. But to start, we're going to look back at the biggest sports stories, or the biggest stories at MMA. And
those are the biggest sports stories.
Yes, they are the biggest. And on the heels of UFC 200 or 211, there's definitely lots to talk about. So let's kind of jump right in, and we'll kind of work our way through media week.
Yeah.
The first thing was the summer press conference tour on Friday. That was before the official weigh-ins. They're doing these press conferences now to make sure that people actually come to the official weigh-ins, at least from the media, not the fans. The official, the ceremonial weigh-ins are for the fans, not, you know, the media gets all the information at the official weigh-ins earlier. But this was a interesting thing. They had listed off a few names who were going to be there. There's a tagline that said more fighters will be announced, or more athletes will be scheduled to attend, but they didn't give you any kind of indication of who. So everybody kind of expected fight announcements to be, you know, made. Walking around the fighter hotel that morning, I ran into Chris Weidman, which seemed a little peculiar. You know, Amanda Nunes had posted a picture on Instagram of her on a plane. That was kind of a hint. You know, there were some other things like that were hint. The two best who were, I think, did the best at keeping quiet were Daniel Cormier and Jon Jones.
That one, I think,
kind of caught everybody off guards by a lot. And I think it's crazy that they didn't even promote that, because that would have really packed the stands. But anyways, I thought it was really cool how they did it.
Mm.
I think the UFC PR team, there's some new blood there, new influences or new ideas are being welcomed. And I think they're doing a lot of cool things. And I think the way that the press conference started was really cool. For those of you who didn't see it, it started like this. There was a big screen hanging down, and they were playing, I think, an episode of Ultimate Fighter, or maybe UFC 211 Countdown beforehand. And then it switched to this promo package that, like, listed off all these fights mixed in with highlights, and that kind of confirmed everything. When they showed the Jones-Cormier on the screen that was official for UFC 211, the crowd went nuts. And typically at these press conferences, you're looking at the stage and it's empty, and Dana White comes out, and then he introduces everybody one by one, and they all file on. Instead, the screen drops, and everybody's sitting where they need to be sitting, and it was a really cool moment. Like, you could tell that it caught everybody off guard. All the media people were sitting there behind cameras, and all of a sudden it happens, and everybody's scrambling to push record, guilty. And it was just a real cool moment. I think it caught the fans off guard. They seemed to really enjoy it. It caught the media off guard. Personally, I thought it was cool and different than the typical thing.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting. So they're doing things like that, and I thought that was
That is really dope. I like that. Anything switching up and any cool reveal like that is exciting.
Yeah, they're adding a little flair.
Yeah, I like that.
The strategy of not announcing who's going to be there. I mean, you say Amanda Nunes and Weidman and Cormier and Jones, like, people will pack.
Yeah.
That, to be fair, the line was already around the building to get into the weigh-ins, which is in itself very impressive.
Sure.
But, you know, it's crazy to think how much more packed it could have been. That being said, the press conference, as we learned afterwards, there was a fight backstage before it began. While they were trying to get everyone to their seats, Jon Jones and Daniel Cormier, as they're known to do when they're near each other, got into a fight. Jones said something about Cormier's children. Cormier responded by throwing water bottles. Fun little tidbit that I learned because Mike Chiesa posted a video of it on Fox Sports Procast. Backstage, so you can actually kind of see the aftermath of the fight once everybody stepped in. It's crazy. Chris Weidman and Kelvin Gastelum are in the middle trying to hold these guys apart. You know, the fighters are in there trying to separate these two guys, not just the security and the PR team, which is just to show how intense it was. But in the video, Chiesa holds up a monster can and shows that it's opened and empty. So they don't put full monster cans out there anymore like they used to, obviously, because of the whole Conor McGregor thing at UFC 202.
Which, him and Nate Diaz and Jake Shields throwing coffee and monster cans.
Right, which is interesting. Obviously, they give them water so they can stay hydrated. They're under hot lights and they're talking and they need to have, you know, their
no more metal. Working. No more metal.
Right, but then when the I didn't notice it at the time, but afterwards, looking back at the video, all the water bottles had been removed as well. So nothing was on the stage. So
that's hilarious.
Then, of course, as the press conference went on, there was the moment where
they didn't need water bottles or cans.
Mike Chiesa rushed Kevin Lee to attack him. And the other thing you noticed is that when the screen dropped, there were two security people between Jones and DC standing right behind the podium, which kind of seemed like an oversight precaution thing. And there was another security guy sitting next to DC, basically, which kind of seemed like maybe they're just being cautious. But now, knowing what happened, it makes sense.
they were understaffed. They needed more security.
Right, which was crazy to think that you had no idea that we're all watching the screen and it happened right behind there, but nobody had any idea that was going on.
That's crazy.
But anyways, Chiesa Lee fight. So there's a lot of fighting going on at press conferences. Is that a good thing?
Yeah, I'm fine with it.
You're fine with it?
Yeah, I don't really. I mean, listen, it can go bad. Like Michael Chiesa ran after Kevin Lee. Kevin Lee threw a real punch that looked like it connected. Amanda Nunes put her fist on a Valentina's face, Shevchenko's face. Like, injuries can happen and things can go wrong then. So it could end up really bad and hurting a lot of people and the bottom line for a lot of people, and that's bad. Here's why I'm fine with it. If we're going to do the artifice of making people pose in a necessarily and just naturally confrontational position, meaning we're going to have them face up close to one another and ask them to put their fists up, and we can't expect these things not to happen. I think it's unnatural to do that. Like, if you and me are on the street, Mike, someone, there's a certain distance that someone I don't know with a certain posture or a certain demeanor that I'm going to, you know, and you're going to allow them to get, you know, to us. We're, you know, arm's length is about as close as anyone ever needs to get. If we're going to make them get closer,
stay out of my bubble.
Yeah, you know, if we're going to force them into each other's bubbles, these things are going to happen. So at that point, I'm not interested in, like, making a black sheep out of any one of the fighters that does it. Do I think it could end, you know, it could result in some bad things happening, like cuts or fights, you know? But Chiesa and Lee are fighting in 6 weeks. A cut happens there, fights called. So yeah, it could go wrong. But if we're gonna make them do this stuff, I don't personally like dislike it. I think it's natural, so I can't blame these guys and girls.
And we didn't even touch on the fact that Nunes and Shevchenko, because they made them stare down after fighters. Nunes and Shevchenko had a little moment where she kind of swiped at Shevchenko's hand. Afterwards, Nunes said it was because Shevchenko touched her face. But Nunes turned in such a way that her back was to the crowd and media, and she said that's why we didn't pick up on that. Shevchenko touched her face because it was her right hand coming on the blind side from the center.
Anyways. No, I think you're right. No, but I think that's exactly the type of point I'm you know, making. Everyone was thinking of Matt and Nunes as like a monster, but hey, they're just they have a history. You're making them get close to each other. Someone makes a little contact, the other person's going to make more contact. That's kind of the way it goes.
There's two like schools of thoughts, it seems to be, on this. There's the people who wish UFC fighters would act like other athletes and be more professional and whatnot. And then there's the other people who they like the sport because they like this stuff. They like, it's like real professional wrestling to them in some regards. But you know, this stuff like this helps sell fights. It's part of what made Conor McGregor so popular.
Right.
And it's part of what catapulted him. And, you know, this, you talk about people selling fights and you can't criticize Demetrius Johnson for pay-per-view buys when he just says things and he doesn't cause these kinds of dust-ups
at for sure.
Press conferences. So it's like, which one do you want?
No, for sure. And also, I don't think UFC athletes really act more out of line than other athletes. I don't think the crime blotters bear that out to be true. You know, I think, you know, by and large, they're really, really respectful, especially when you consider, you know, how violent the confrontations are. You know, 9 times out of 10, Mike, you know this, even if there's a lot of trash talk after the fights, these fighters, you know, they hug it out and stuff because they have respect. But yeah, I think
McGregor Diaz did after Taylor.
Exactly. You know, now in later moments, are they still going to talk trash? Sure, but they do share something, and I think most of the time they appreciate that. But yeah, it's just tough to criticize. It's okay to not want to see that stuff happen, But it's tough for me to criticize individual fighters once we set up a sport in a way that we're going to make them square up in that way. Like we're gonna, you know, we want this drama. You know, the UFC is going to use clips of all of those things for. They're going to use clips of everything but talking. They already did actually later that weekend when they showed Daniel Cormier and John Jones going at it, and they showed Chiesa and Lee going at it on the broadcast. The only thing they didn't show was John Jones is relishing how awesome cocaine is. But, you know, that was like a line they wouldn't cross. But the actual violence and the physical confrontations, oh, they'll milk that forever, even if someone gets fined off of it by
even
a state commission.
Even in the lead up to Jones DC 1, they showed the fight. Oh, well.
Which they got fined, this was, they got, I think, fined for, but they used it to promote the
right.
fight. Right.
Yeah. This is, the, of course, that was, they had, that fight got postponed, so yeah. they had time to especially work it in yeah. to the promotional materials. But anyways, the thing is, there's casual fans or new yeah. fans, just relatively new fans to the sport who come in lately as the sport's grown in popularity. And things like this sell the fights. And yeah. that's unfortunate. Well, I don't want to say unfortunately, but it's a sure. reality of the
sure.
situation.
Sure.
And there's probably a lot of people who are, you know, fans who don't know who Michael Chiesa is and don't know who Kevin Lee is. Mm-hmm. And now that they've seen this, like, they're going to turn into that Oklahoma City card, which is
yeah.
a good card.
It is
like,
a good card, actually.
Felice
yeah.
Herrick's fighting on there. Johnny Hendricks is fighting
Guida's
on
the card. Clay
Guida's on the card.
Good card.
Really but, good card. You know, that helped make them, that fight, that whole card more
Agreed.
Visible.
Agreed.
So
I have a much more of a problem with Kevin Lee mentioning someone's mother than him throwing
see,
a punch.
He, okay, so at UFC 211 in the press area, they brought, you know, they bring all the fighters back for their post-fight interviews after they get out of the cage. And sometimes at particularly big events where there's a lot of UFC fighters floating around, they'll bring fighters who are in attendance backstage. And Kevin Lee was one of them. And, you know, he talked about it and he kind of seemed a little bit confused about it because he didn't say anything really bad about his mom.
Just mentioned
it. And I don't think he said anything bad. He said something worse that Chiesa didn't even acknowledge later.
Yeah.
And I think he was asked about that during the press conference, and he admitted that it wasn't in, or didn't admit, but he mm-hmm. said it wasn't intentional. It was just he didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he just said his mom was going to have tickets, and yeah. she probably will.
Right. It's just mentioning someone's mother. And the reason I like that is Nate Diaz. Remember Nate Diaz criticizing Jose Aldo for letting Conor McGregor just punk him all over the world, touch him, you know, call him names. And he said, you know, if I was there, you do touch me or you say one of these things, you get in my face like that, I don't care who's around. We're gonna fight right then and there. I think Michael Chiesa drew a line. And, you know, maybe it's an irrational line. But he said, you know what? Actually, no. The second you mentioned my mother, I'm going to fight you now. Actually, personally, thought that was good. I think that's fine. Like, I think that's cool. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not saying that's generalizable behavior everyone should, you know, should go for, but I actually respected Michael Chiesa for just arbitrarily drawing a line in the sand when someone was just mentioning his family. And he talked about it afterwards and just stuff I read. He was like, yeah, I'm a mama's boy. Like, you know, I don't need him talking about my mother. Yeah, like my mom, you know, it just really pissed me off. So I don't even know if it was like predetermined, but I think it like really just like tugged on something. Like, what? Don't talk about my mother at all.
Unfortunately, I think he just showed him his
yeah.
hand.
Yeah, don't say
Michael
that.
Lee's gonna torment, yeah. or Kevin Lee's going to torment him for the next couple weeks or 6 weeks.
Yeah, Chiesa better fight angry. Well,
So for those of you listening on the podcast version of this later, we do the show live on Facebook, and we can interact with the fans in real time. And I posted that you can shoot us your thoughts and questions, and we'll read them on air. We got a couple in, and I just wanted to get those on before we talked about the actual
yeah.
fights that people paid to see at UFC 211, not the ones they got for free. So first we have Alan Rose who said, when do you expect to see McGregor return? That's up in the air because Dana White set a deadline for this weekend to get a deal done. They've reached a deal to have a Mayweather fight done, but they still need to work out a deal with Mayweather, so who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's
other than that,
that's interesting.
You know, if they go back to MSG at the end of the year, that might be when you see him return. Otherwise, there's not really a whole lot of information.
Right.
Jefferson Da Silva, he says, what's your opinion about Cigano's future in the UFC? Now, this is a good segue back to UFC 211. Junior Dos Santos lost the main event to Stipe Miocic, who knocked him out in about 2 minutes, if I remember correctly, 2.5 or something like that. And in the process, Stipe Miocic tied the heavyweight record for title defenses, which stands at a whopping 2. But That also puts into question Junior Dos Santos's future. He's fought Stipe twice. Yeah. It was a decisive defeat. You know, so what do you think? What is your read?
I'm imagining he'll continue to fight. I think Junior Dos Santos is skill-wise one of the best heavyweights in history. He's just out of his prime. And by that, I mean he's taken enough damage and age enough where his reflexes aren't where they need to be to beat the best in the world. And there's big consequences when your reflexes slow down in fights, and we saw that for him. Even just in a couple years, his first fight with Stipe Miocic, although I scored that fight for Miocic, it was a closer fight, right? And this one, he was just very much several steps behind Miocic, who himself is not like very young, and himself has probably had plenty of damage as well. He slurs his speech pretty good already. I think Junior should. We talk about this a lot, Mike. In terms of health, Junior Dos Santos, I would love for him to be able to have another thing now to go to full time that he can find satisfaction in, that he can make a living doing, because although he can beat 99.9% of all humanity in a fight right now, I don't think he stands a good chance of being a champion again in the division. And that's a precipitous fall, because he's amazing. He's a great fighter. So if a great fighter can no longer compete at the level that they used to, It's tough. It's not pick up sticks. It's not baseball. Like when you get slower, you get hit more in fighting. So it's tough. I don't know what his future is going to be. I'm sure he's not going to quit. I kind of wish he would, and he had other options. Me personally,
I asked Stipe Miocic this at media day about the young crop of heavyweight fighters coming up, and he was kind of Stipe is not known for necessarily always giving the best quote. So he kind of didn't really give a particularly interesting answer, but I asked him about it. You know, to a lot of people, Stipe Miocic represents a new era in the heavyweight division. People like Junior Dos Santos and your Alistair Overeems, and this kind of old guard veteran moving out. Mm. And there's a lot of people, and for the first time in a while, a lot of young guys in the heavyweight division that are drawing a lot of interest. Francis Ngannou, yeah. Derek Lewis. These are heavy hitter guys coming up. And you know, Francis Ngannou, it's like, could you imagine him fighting Junior Dos Santos? Like, it just seems,
with his quickness and his size right now, it could go bad.
It seems scary, but yeah. Like, you know, if that guy gets the heavyweight title fight, it's not a foregone conclusion that Stipe Miocic reaches that third title defense.
Sure, sure, 100%.
So, you know, he's such a nice guy, Junior Dos Santos. He's a good role model. He's polite. At one point at open workouts, the media was asked him that if he had to trash talk Junior Stipe Miocic, how would he and what would he do? Because he's that kind of guy. Like, he just won't say anything but nice things.
Right.
And he went on this story about how the nice guy always finishes last. And he felt good going into this fight because he felt like it was two nice guys. Mm. And regardless of who won, the nice guy would walk away. That's the question. That's the answer he gives when you ask him to.
Yeah, to trash talk. Yeah.
He doesn't say, true. I guess Stipe's ugly. But
yeah, right. He's a stone cold warrior because he doesn't have to get. I mean, look at him in the cage. He looks mean. He looks angry. But he doesn't have to put on a facade before. He can go in there and attempt to do his job. Same with Stipe. I mean, Stipe seems really easygoing until he's fighting. That's a truly dangerous person.
That guy is all jokes all the time. Like at media day, somebody would ask him a question and he would joke, and then it seems like he'd always be like, no, I'm kidding, and then he would give an answer. But
that's awesome.
He said at the UFC, the post-fight press conference, Stipe Miocic, that he doesn't care about the title record. Do you think he should?
Yeah, I think
think he's downplaying it.
I mean, I think he may be downplaying it, but I think I think that's a good aspirational goal for him, to not care about things, because what does that do for him? He'll have another opponent in front of him soon enough with his own particular challenges, and he'll have to think about that. If he adds on to that, legacy, history, I mean, there's nothing you can do about that. That one thing will follow the other. If he manages to win his next fight, he'll have history. So thinking about it more will just add pressure. I'm sure he's smart enough to think that, and you know, maybe he's not consciously thinking about it, and that's why he's so successful, is that he just has trained himself and his mind to focus on what he can control and what he can be doing. So yeah, I think it's good. I mean, I don't know what games he is playing with himself and his own head and stuff to focus on the right things, but Yeah, that is that's a good answer. He said not caring about it is the right answer.
He said he likes to win, and that's just his focus on keep winning. And he's like, if I keep winning, I'll just keep being champion.
Sounds like that's a really healthy attitude. I mean, I bet he does care enough about winning every single time that he doesn't need to add more incentive, you know?
And he goes back to work at the firehouse tomorrow.
Yeah, that's awesome, man.
Which is still one of the coolest things I think about him.
It's pretty cool.
He did say, though, that people do start to recognize him a bit more when he comes to car crashes or wherever he gets dispatched. That's amazing.
I mean, you know, it's crazy because I know guys that train and fight and that are and that also are firemen. I don't know any women personally, but you know, and they always say, yeah, you know, it actually works out pretty well the schedule because you're off for a certain amount of days and all that. And I'm sure that's true, but it does seem just gnarly to have multiple full time jobs. But I'll tell you what,
he's not one of the fighters doing it because he needs the money.
I mean,
he's underpaid, but he's paid well compared to other UFC.
I guess
fighters.
So, but I mean, the thing I'm thinking about, he has no pension being heavyweight champion of the world. He has no year-round insurance being heavy champion of the world. So I actually think, no, he could use that money. Like, he could use the pension and the benefits,
that's
you know.
True.
But I'm not saying that's why he's doing it.
No.
You know, but it seems like he loves being a firefighter as well. But, yeah, it can't hurt having an actual pension and stuff like that.
Danielle Taylor, she's a strawweight, I want to say. Mm-hmm. She's a corrections officer.
Yeah.
She fought recently.
She fought in the Nashville card. She
a corrections officer.
She fought she is. She fought
She won.
We would try to what am I blanking? We had tried to get her on the show earlier that week. Oh my gosh, Jessica Penny, former strawweight title challenger, super super tough. Yeah. She's a corrections officer. That's insane. That's also a stressful job. Working in jails or prisons.
As someone who just started Orange is the New Black, I can't. I
know that's enough reality for me to not want to ever be in that situation.
But we have Ken Shamrock joining us in about 7 minutes, so I want to move on to the Joanna Jędrzejczyk. I said that right.
We definitely did it.
The media thing. It's like you can't try to slowly say it. You just got to go fast and get it out. It's the only way.
That hole.
So Joanna champion. Yeah. She fought Jessica Andrade. A lot of people thought that Andrade could present a challenge for her because she has a lot of strength and she can be like a pit bull. First of all, she can take a punch. We learned that.
Mm-hmm.
But Joanna pretty much dominated that fight. Mm. The first round, I think you could have given to Andrade, but all the judges gave her all five rounds. One of them gave her a 10-8 round at one point to give her a 50-44 score. I asked her at the post-fight press conference if she thought this was the most dominant performance of her career. She said she did, and she said before going into the fight that now that she's moved to American Top Team, she's going to another level as far as her skills go, she's going to be more dominant than ever. And she made the move before UFC 205, but she said she only had 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
Now she has more time to spend there and improve, and I think that showed. So,
yeah.
Do you think it was her best performance?
Well, I mean, I think it was amazing. I don't think it was the most dominant performance. I think clearly she was more dominant against people like Carla Esparza and stuff like that. But I thought it was an amazing performance. The adjustments that she makes as the fight goes on are really a wondrous thing to watch. Her opponent Andrade not only took a hit, she delivered it. And my Muay Thai coach, Matt Johnson, who I was watching the fight with here in Chicago, made a good point. He's like, in Muay Thai, the culture is once you get hurt, your coaches make you basically throw elbows because you know that you could be, you know, you can go out any second. So you're throwing to cut to get a stop, but you're throwing to hurt. And if you look in that first round, Joanna started going to the elbows pretty early. She has great elbows. She did it all throughout the fight, especially on separations from the clinch. But she was hurt badly, it looked to me. And she was also manhandled, so to speak. I shouldn't say manhandled. Person handled big time, thrown around a bit early on and showed good hips and getting back up. But Andrade was a real threat. She hurt her. She tagged her actually a little bit throughout the fight, every single round, and she never stopped coming forward. So I thought it was an incredible performance for Joanna because as it went on, she got sharper and sharper. She started cutting angles. She wasn't fighting in straight lines anymore. And that's when you saw in the final round, I believe it was, she got like a standing arm triangle clinch basically getting the back of Andrade a couple times. She created that off of her footwork. She got the back off of her footwork standing and made her opponent miss. Super, super impressive. I mean, it's hard to say any one fight of hers is more impressive than the other to me, because she does seem to be getting better and better, and she can really turn it up over the her second fight against Claudia Gardella. She looked in big trouble in the first two rounds, and then just really kept the same pace, got sharper and sharper as her opponent got more and more unbalanced on her feet, and also stole that fight away. So she's awesome. I don't doubt she's getting better and better. Now she's getting to spend whole training camps with the likes of Mike Brown. It looks like not any longer, but Kami, the wrestling coach there, a phenomenal coach, American Top Team, who I didn't realize until this fight is leaving American Top Team. But yeah, I bet she's going to get better and better. For certain, she places plenty of stiff challenges, but she's got everything she needs to get sharper and sharper.
The thing that might be concerning about her is it doesn't seem like she weathers damage well. Like she does in the fact that she can take a punch,
yeah.
But like physically, like a Diaz almost, like a Diaz is gonna bleed.
Yeah, no, I mean she'll get caught. She doesn't have that BJ Penn skin that never gets cut. Like
she did, it did look in social media posts that it. That kind of went away relatively quickly.
They handled that well. That could have gotten real bad.
But you know, that looks like a big could potentially be a concern for her.
Sure,
going forward. But
no, it could happen.
You know, she looks so good. You talked about her making adjustments, and it didn't seem like Andrade made any adjustments as the fight went on. She just kept pushing forward, and Joanna would just hit her before more often than not before she could ever do whatever she wanted to do. It's like she would step forward to get in position to do something.
Yeah,
and Joanna's already hit her twice and moved on.
Yeah,
and.
It's impressive. And she wasn't doing that the first round or the second round. She gets better as the fight goes on. It's pretty amazing.
And in her next fight, she will tie Ronda Rousey's record for title defenses in women's division at 6. This is her fifth.
In the UFC. Yeah.
In the UFC.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not counting Rousey's strike force.
Sure. Cyborg's 10-year reign as a champion. But it's incredibly impressive. And she's making history fast already. It's pretty remarkable.
Do you think she is... Because we had a column go up on fansided.com today from Oscar Stephen Willis. He wrote that she could be the UFC's next big star. Do you think she's still in a position where she hasn't quite assumed that throne, but has the potential to? Or do you think she's already established herself as a star?
Well, I think she's established herself as a star. I think she can get much more attention than she has. I think the UFC can continue to try to push her. And I think her star can rise, for sure. We're just talking about fame and notoriety. I think the sky's the limit for her. I think she can be an international household name. You know, in Europe, she can become a household name. In the United States, she could as well. So, no, she's definitely a star. Is she done? Is this as far as she can go in terms of notoriety? No, I imagine not. She needs to be headlining pay-per-views. And she can, I think. She's pretty remarkable. Even just... rhetorically talking with her, like she's got personality. So yeah, I think she can be one of the next biggest stars in the UFC, and I bet she's not done climbing yet.
Now, she mentioned during open workouts that she wanted to pursue that flyweight title when they create that division. She thought it was a good thing. It's been a great thing to see the UFC embrace the flyweight and featherweight divisions and launch those. I think that was done finally. In part in response to Bellator you know, trying to snatch up some fighters to create those divisions, knowing that's where that UFC was lacking.
Yeah.
So
time for atomweight soon. 105 is their talent rich area.
I think that's I think that's something that they've done in response, but it's a good thing. And
definitely,
it looks like the inaugural or the next season of The Ultimate Fighter will be to like the strawweight was to crown a champion. So
pretty cool
for the flyweight belt. So. Would you give, after that's all done and the two tough people fight for the title, like Carlos Esparza and Namahuna, would you then give Joanna the next shot at that title?
If she wants it, yeah. Like, she deserves it. You know, if Miesha Tate were still fighting, she would have an argument for it or something, you know. But, yeah, if she wants it, absolutely. I think Joanna should be given basically whatever she wants. I think her marketability would increase if she's able to go after a second title. And... I don't know if she would want to or not, or how her body would respond, but give her the opportunity if she wants to also hold both at the same time and defend both. That would be crazy.
She threw a bit of shade at Conor McGregor at open workouts.
Oh, did she?
Unintentionally. Unintentionally. They were represented by the same managements. They've been very cordial on social media. Conor McGregor.
I heard she hates his guts.
Yeah. Conor McGregor, like, congratulated her, gave her props. But she was like, she just mentioned like I would want to win both belts and actually defend both belts, and we're all kind of like, ooh.
That's cool that she will want to do that. I think she should, and I think that just makes the her star grow larger and larger.
So it's 2:30, which means we have Ken Shamrock on the phone. He is promoting the Penthouse panel on May 20th, Saturday in Chicago. If you are in the Chicago area, you can buy a ticket to that. It's a really cool event they've done in Chicago a few times. Basically, they get some MMA legends together. I think last time Matt Hughes was on the panel. I'm drawing blanks at who the other guys were on the panel, but it's all legends and big names of the sports. This week, they're doing a little bit of a Lion's Den thing.
Yeah.
Ken Shamrock, Frank Shamrock, and Guy Mezger, three legends of the sport, all sitting there talking. So, you know, we're excited to get to talk to Ken.
Absolutely. So, we good to go? Yeah. Okay. All right, Ken, thanks for being on the show. Really excited to chat with you. I remember back when I started training, I was in high school. Someone gave me, one of my coaches, Ramiro, gave me your book, your memoir, Inside the Lion's Den. So much fun reading that. And one of the things that stands out to me was when you first went to Japan, through pro wrestling and mixed rules fighting like Pankration, and you know, forerunner of MMA. And you talked about being a new guy in the gym there and the intense training, how rough the guys were, the injuries you sustained and had to train and fight through. The thousands of squats you would have to do at a time. Looking back at those moments when you were in a new country, learning new things, getting beat up, pushing your body past your limits, and fighting through injuries, what was your motivation? Did you see a viable career at the end of that tunnel? Did you just want to show the rest of the guys in the room that you could hack it? Like, what really was driving you, would you say?
Well, first of all, I didn't have much to really lean back on. You know, I mean, came from the group home, didn't have really much college education. So for me, really, it was about becoming somebody and needed to find what my niche was. I didn't want to go back to where I came from, which was, you know, troubled youth and nothing but trouble, getting in trouble, and then trying to drag myself out of that trouble. So I felt like I found something that I felt like I could be really good at. And I loved doing it. And so really my mindset was really to become some, at least become something. And I felt like this sport, this event could do that for me. And once I got into it, my mindset was like, nobody was going to be better than me. I was going to do whatever it took for people to say my name whenever they mentioned this event. I wanted to be that guy.
And when did you... Was there a moment where you felt you could be that guy, like when you knew you could be good at this and catch on?
Well, I think when I had my very first match in Japan and people started chanting my name, I didn't even know it until Sami Saranaka told me they're chanting your name. That was my first fight. And I think once I heard that and the training that went into that first fight and then my first fight, once I heard that, I was like, I'm home. I'm like, I found something. But then it turned into now being the best. They're like, I was nowhere near those guys, like Kanaki, Suzuki, or Takata, or Maeda. I was nowhere near those guys. And yet, my first fight, my desire was to beat them. My desire was to dominate this league. And so then I started down that path. I knew how to do it, and was to put the effort in, put the time in, do more than the next guy, and be completely focused on my direction, and that's what I did.
Was that, Ken, was that the first time in your life that you had felt that type of drive to be the best at something, or did you always have that attitude growing up, playing any of the sports you played?
That's what I did. Well, when I was younger. I was in and out of juvenile hall. I didn't have anybody real raise me. Then I ended up at Shamrock Boys Home, where Bob Shamrock became my parent through the ward of the court. And so when I started into sports, I had a lot of anger and frustration. So I directed my anger and frustration into that. But then it became something positive, which I didn't know at the time. But I felt good that people were patting me on the back for being aggressive and for being that guy people feared. And even though in my mind it didn't seem normal. But I said, well, fine. I said, if I can knock the snot out of somebody, I'm going to blow snot bubbles, and they're going to pat me on the back for it, then I'm in. And so it really just started down that line where people started to care. They worked extra time with me to make my grades get better. People spent time with me to make sure I didn't get in trouble. It seemed like I was getting special preferences. And because that was happening, I became like, I felt like I was important. And that, so I started working harder to get more of that. And really it just became a process for me and a way of life for me. No, I knew where I could actually get that pat on the back. And that's really what most kids, when they're in that position, they really want to be accepted. And if they're not, they're going to find ways to make people recognize who they are.
Did sports give you an outlet to get rid of that anger when you were young, Ken, like to get it out of your system? Or was it tough for you because you were getting, all of a sudden, getting rewarded for aggression, so it was maybe difficult for you to turn it off?
Well, I think that, and where I was lucky was that I had Bob Shamrock, who later became my father. Ooh. But he really helped me, kind of compartmentalize it, I guess, if it's the right terminology, to be able to keep it on the field, keep it on the wrestling mat, but don't take it out in public. And there was a couple of incidences where I, you know, went beyond the lines because I wasn't understanding of all these things. And when someone got in my face, my first instinct was to punch him. And so he helped me understand through, you know, different ways of discipline. When those things happened, and he broke it down to me one time when he explained it in a terminology in football where he said people count on you. You got your teammates, you got the fans, the people that come to watch you, you got the teachers who put time into you, you got, you know, me and Dee, who is my mom now, who care about you and want you to see you succeed. There's so many, that your friends. There's so many people around you now that believe in you. So when you do something that hurts these people, it's not just you that's getting hurt. There's all these people around that you've built a relationship with now. Hmm. And I said, I started to understand it. And he said, it's no different than, you know, when you're outside of all of that, if you get in trouble. There are still people who care about you, not just on the football field and you break the rules and you're penalizing the team and you're costing maybe a championship. I said, but it's also in life. The same thing works in life where you break the rules. All those same people you are hurting. So you can't just go out there and punch somebody in the face and not think that there's going to be people that are going to get hurt over your actions, because there is. And so for me, it really helped me understand life through sports.
And you talked about sports giving you a path to become somebody and people that would go on to be your family, like Bob Shamrock when he adopted you. So much of your life, because you certainly did become someone and someone who was well-known and famous in multiple realms, in fighting and professional wrestling internationally and here in the United States, you got famous. And so much of your life became public. And family drama became public. And many of your struggles were publicly discussed as well. I'm just kind of curious. It would seem like you wanted to become someone. You wanted people to know your name. Has fame ever become even just a little bit of a burden for you?
I can answer that pretty clearly. It hasn't been. I've always been open about what has happened to me, the things that I've gone through, because I feel like it's just another avenue for me to be venting my frustrations or my anger or my hurt. It's being able to let other people know where I've been and what has happened and the way I've gotten out of it. And that just because I've gotten out of it doesn't mean that it's gone. It doesn't mean that it doesn't still bother me, because it does. But it's just being able to recognize that it is bothering you and that it's pushing you in a direction, and that you're able to stop yourself from doing something stupid because you're going through something. So over time, you can understand those feelings and you can understand the different things that are happening to you and be able to control them and not put yourself in a bad situation. So I've always been open about who I am, where I've come from, and all the things that have happened to me. And I think because I've done that, I'm not afraid of people bringing it up or talking about it, because it's not going to shock anybody or me when they do.
Ken, we don't know how much you follow MMA now and the different happenings at current events, but as a fan since I was 10 in 1993 watching the first UFC and covering it for a living since 2005, it's right now, 2017 seems like a really unique moment. In the past, we had individuals like yourself every once in a while would speak up or be critical of promoters like the UFC regarding pay and treatment and actually kind of battle with promoters and talk about different issues. Right now, though, to me, I can't remember another time in the sport of MMA's history where we've had more name fighters speaking out against the UFC, battling with the UFC regarding pay, benefits, treatment, and things of that nature.
I've always said that was going to be a problem. As soon as this all catches up, it's going to be a nightmare for the Fertittas and Dana White because of not exposing the amount of money that was being made and what they were actually paying themselves, as opposed to what the fighters who were actually bringing in the fans, what they were actually making. A lot of them were like happy because they got $500,000 or $1 million, or even up to a point where someone made over $1 million, and then fans would say, "Oh, what were you complaining about? You made $3 million," and then because they don't know, they don't get to size it up against what the actual company is making, which is up to $100 million when you were actually making the $3 million, and that you were the main event, you were the marquee guy that was bringing in that $100 million. And that you wanted to get 1% of that. So for me, I think that has always been, at least in my mind, was always going to be an issue. And I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet, because the books haven't been opened up yet. I know we've got new owners. I believe in some time, if that does ever happen, someday it will. I just don't know whether it'll be in my lifetime or whether in the next one. I don't know. But I know it's going to happen, because it always does. It always rises to the surface. And I think when that happens, I think then it's going to be very difficult. Maybe not for the Fertittas, because they've been in this business a while. They're used to this kind of stuff. But Dana White was definitely the face, the guy that stood in front of the cameras and that boasted on how great they were doing, and then making excuses of why they weren't paying the fighters. But I think when that does come out, and they do see the amount of money that was being made, when the books do open up, I think it's going to be hard for Dana to walk around in public. And listen, I'm not saying this to be mean or vengeful or anything like that. I'm just saying it because it's something that I believe. Listen, it's my opinion, so don't go freaking out if people are reading this and saying it's true, because it's not true. It's my opinion I think is going to happen.
Ken, you've dealt with so many promoters over the years as a fighter and wrestler, and you've always seemed to be aware of your worth and said and done whatever you needed to behind the scenes or in public to kind of ensure that you get that. Is that an attitude that you've always had, or did it take getting burned a couple times to become that way?
That's not, in my opinion, is not the way that I do things. I accept whatever I made. I've got no qualms about me doing the contract. My only qualms was that I didn't get to negotiate from a fair stance, because I wasn't getting to negotiate from the numbers, the real numbers that were coming in, and all the back stuff that we don't get to see. I wasn't sitting in a room being able to negotiate from a fair stance. That's my only thing. But because that's what happened, it is what happened. The only time I speak up is when I actually are on the outside looking in and seeing what they're doing to other fighters. It has nothing to do with me, because I am set with what I have done, and up to this point, I'm not fighting for anything for myself. What I'm trying to do is fight for at least some equal pay for the fighters now, and for the fighters that when I was actually going through there and ended up, the younger guys were coming up, I was actually speaking up for them, not for me, but for them, because I felt like the direction that it was going, that it wasn't going to be a pretty sight at the end of it. And I think, hindsight now, it's always 2020. Now we're starting to see what I was saying in the earlier days about how I believed that they weren't being paid fair, and I was being told to shut up. by fighters and by the organization and blackballed in many situations because I was speaking about something that I believed was true. And now I think that now that you look at 20 years down the road, I think that people now are saying, okay, maybe Shamrock was right in what he said.
Well, you talked about speaking up for other fighters from things you saw from the outside. Would you ever consider, Ken, working specifically to help organize other fighters as part of a fighters association or a labor union?
Well, listen, I'm not an attorney. I'm not an organizer, per se, in any political sense. I basically, I see something wrong, something I feel is wrong, I speak out. Mm. And I have no problem supporting anybody that does do something like that that I believe is doing the right thing. But as far as me leading that, I don't think I'm the guy.
Ken, one of the things we wanted to ask you about most, you fought for so long, is the transition from being a very active athlete and competitor to the path towards retirement. The sports world seems really cruel because you can be a really young man or woman but be an old athlete. And as a professional athlete, you have so much of your identity wrapped up in competing. You have so much of your professional and your personal life wrapped up in it, your work. How hard is it to move to another part of one's life and adapt to heading or to needing to slow down and move towards retirement as an athlete?
Well, for me, it wasn't, when I started into it, it was something I wanted to do. I had a passion for it. I started getting good at it. I felt like I could actually make something of myself. I felt important. I ran that whole gamut. I became the best that there was at that time in two different countries in the world, really. Got a nickname as the world's most dangerous man that was given to me by a TV station. So I really accomplished everything I ever wanted to, you could ever accomplish in that. Then it came to a point in time where my skills had diminished, and I wasn't in the position to really compete in a ranking system. I knew that. But then when people talked about retirement, I always heard people go, I want to go fishing, I want to go camping, or I just want to eat food, sit on the couch, and be lazy. I mean, everybody has their own thing they want to do when they retire. I wanted to fight. I wanted to retire and just fight, enjoy myself. I didn't want to be in the competitive sports spotlight, although I was pushed into it. And I didn't mind it at all, don't get me wrong. But I also knew that I was not a world-caliber fighter. And that, if they wanted to use me in the limelight and sell tickets and fill the arena, then so be it. I'll fight as long as the fights make sense. And if you look at my career, other than Tito Ortiz, with me being 40 years old, 39, 40, 42 years old when I fought him three times, out of my prime, way out of my prime, and him being in his prime, that was the only time that I really stepped out and fought something that probably wasn't the smartest thing to do, but I did it because I realized if I didn't, UFC wouldn't be where it's at today. I knew that if somebody didn't step in and build the ratings and try to get the UFC back up again, that they would close the doors. And then we would have different people trying to start it up, and we'd have all these little things running around. Maybe somebody comes in, builds another organization, and it flies. I don't know. Hmm. But I knew at that point in time that I had an obligation to step in the ring and fight Tito Ortiz in order to bring the ratings up and save MMA. I believe that. That's just my opinion. And I did that. After that, I went out and I fought for my fun, for me to go out there and enjoy my life, being able to compete and train and have that atmosphere and fight all over the world in different events and being able to fight people that would be somewhat in my caliber because I knew I had, a broken back, a broken neck, busted shoulder, and a knee that had all been replaced, but I was not moving well from the stand-up to the ground, no question. But I still loved enjoying the competition. So I went out in a safe sense, and I picked fighters that I felt like, hey, I'm not going to get destroyed here, but I can at least go out and have fun. And it wasn't anything other than me retiring and within my own sport and being able to go out and have fun with it. That's it.
Of all the places you have competed and performed in over the across the world, Ken, do you have a favorite?
Well, I wouldn't say favorite, but as far as, the actual style, I enjoyed Pancrase because it was it was a, you know, there's a few things that could change that would make it the ultimate, but I really enjoyed the idea of when you hit the ground that it was strictly submission, that you had to be very skilled in both areas, the striking and the submission, because on the ground, if you took somebody down in mixed martial arts, sorry, no holds barred, you could just pound a guy, right? I mean, you don't have to have submission skills. You could just pound on him.
Right.
And the submission guy has to work through those punches. And I get it. I love both of them. I really did. But I thought that the Vanquish style really forced fighters to be very skilled in both stand-up and the ground, because you couldn't bail out on the ground with just striking.
Hmm.
So, Ken, have you seen what Eddie Bravo has been doing with his combat jiu-jitsu, where it's submission grappling, but open hand strikes are allowed on the ground?
Yeah, I think that, in my opinion, I think that I like that. I like it when, you know, you can mix the no-holds-barred kind of system in with the actual MMA system.
We talked about this when we had Cole Miller on a few weeks ago with the EBI combat jiu-jitsu, and we kind of saw slaps happening for the most part. Not really true hard palm strikes. And Ken, there is a difference. You fought under rules where palm strikes were allowed. There's a difference between a real hard palm strike and just a slap.
Yeah, absolutely. A palm strike is more dangerous than a punch. If it's done right, you hit a guy's nose and that bone. I mean, that's a real deal there. If you hit a guy straight up into the nose, there's a good chance you can drive that bone into the brain. I mean, it's very, very rare and very hard to do, but the potential is definitely there.
So how are you spending your time these days, Ken? You talked about a transitioning in your life. What have you been up to? What do you do?
Well, right now, if you look at my social media sites, you'll see that I'm really starting to reach out into a lot of the different types of businesses right now. I'm starting to learn the lingo. I'm starting to learn how to position myself through, you know, communication. And it's really starting to understand how business it works, you know, and there's a lot of competitiveness in that. So for me right now, I really transitioned more into the business and the tech world, trying to catch up to everybody. But to me, it's exciting to see how it all works and to really get into the verbal confrontations, where they're really not verbal, it's very subtle and very, very, very wise people that know how to communicate and put themselves in a very good position to negotiate good terms in the business world or even in the tech world. So for me right now, I'm a baby in a man's world trying to learn it, but I've got a lot of people around me that are really helping me move fast.
Ken, could you talk to us about the event you got here this Saturday, May 20th in Chicago, the Penthouse panel? It's kind of cool sounding to us from what we've heard about it. You're going to be with two of your old teammates, your brother Frank Shamrock, Guy Metzger, two other former world champions, and sounds pretty interesting. You're going to be giving ticketed fans a chance to sit down with you in a pretty private setting and listen to stories, it sounds like, of you all coming up.
Well, for me, it's exciting because I think that it's the beginning of something that I want to continue to keep doing yearly and just keep adding more to it. But for this year, it's a Penthouse panel. It's going to be in Chicago, May 20th. And basically what we're going to do with myself and Frank Shamrock and Guy Metzger is we're going to talk about the tales from the Lion's Den, you know, the beginning days, genesis, if you might say, of actually the UFC. So it's going to be an exciting night. The doors open at 4 p.m., if you want tickets, you can get them at the Penthouse panel. Eventbrite is where you get the tickets, eventbrite.com. And then click on to Penthouse panel and you can get your tickets there. And again, like I said, there's very minimal seats there. It's going to be more of a cozy environment. So if you want those tickets, you got to jump on quick and get them. So 4 p.m., May 20th, Penthouse panel, Tales from the Lion's Den, myself, Frank Shamrock and Guy Metzger will be there talking about the Lion's Den and the actual beginnings of the no-holds-barred and MMA era.
That's a really cool concept. It seems like, Mike, that it's giving fans a chance to kind of do what we get to do all the time, which is talk to awesome world-class athletes. And, you know, they had the C2E2 comic book convention nearby a couple weeks ago. I had some friends that went to that. And, you know, I see a lot of people paying good money for, like, a quick handshake and a quick photo and, like, 2 seconds with someone that they really admire, an athlete or an actor. This is actually, Ken, you know, basically fans getting to sit down in an intimate setting and hear from you guys with no rush, like an actual real experience.
Yeah, and also too, you're not only do you have, you know, three guys from the Lion's Den, which was the very first no holds barred MMA team put together, which I put that team together, yep. But you have three world champions from the Lion's Den. Talking of the Guy Metzger, who was a champion in pancreas over in Japan with myself, and also in MMA, in the UFC, and then Frank the same, where he was tremendous over in Japan in the pancreas organization. He beat Boss Rosen for the vacant title, so Frank was a champion there. And then, of course, he goes in and beats Tito Ortiz and becomes a champion in the UFC. So it's these great tales for three world champions from the Lion's Den.
And where can fans follow you on social media, Ken?
Yeah, kenshamrock.com. And if you click onto that, you can go to all my social sites. I have Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and pretty much all of them. They're all attached to my website. So go to kenshamrock.com, and you can check out all the things I've got going on. If I was trying to list all the things that I'm doing now, it would probably take me 30 minutes. But it's very exciting times for me. It's a new beginning. I'm rebranding myself. Very, very excited about the future of Ken Shamrock, and also being able to keep the history of the Lion's Den and of No Holds Barred and MMA alive.
Well, that's a worthy goal for sure. Thanks so much, Ken, for being on the X Rounds podcast, man. Really appreciate that.
Hey, I appreciate it, guys, and God bless.
I love that he's no holds barred. For people who don't know this, this sport wasn't always called mixed martial arts. Vale Tudo, no holds barred. When I started training, we called it NHB. Pretty cool. I love that. I love hearing that used again.
It's definitely an old term. I was talking to David Branch in Dallas at UFC 211, and when he said he first started training, it was no holds barred, and Vale Tudo, it wasn't MMA.
That's awesome.
You forget that. You kind of take that for granted now when you talk about MMA, that there is that history, and it's cool that he got to leave it alive. Obviously, Guy Metzger is a Dallas person, so there's always been a special bond with me and that fighter in particular. I was telling Elias off the air that one of my first MMA fight I ever went to was a I don't even remember what it was called. It was in a ballroom at a hotel. I think it was definitely very amateur oriented. There was a girl that I knew in high school through friends who was training at Guy Metzger's gym in Dallas. That's who was cool. Competing, and Ken Shamrock was kind of the overseer of affairs, the host, if you will. He was he came into the ring and did a little speech or whatever. And so that was cool.
That's really cool. And you were set up. You left out kind of a funky part of the story, man.
No, we don't need to go there.
Follow Mike on Twitter for his lurid details. No, but how cool is that?
That'll be coming to a Flow Combat article. But yeah, it was cool. It's cool to hear him on. It's cool to hear him specifically talk about what he wants to do in the future and moving on and whatnot. And again, if you're in Chicago, check that out. It's a really special, unique opportunity. They do this frequently. But you get to go and sit and, you know, you spend an evening with these guys. It's not waiting in line, like
yes.
You said, getting an autograph at a convention. For those of you going to the UFC Fight Fan Expo, and this is no fault of the UFC or anything like that, but so many fans want to meet these fighters that it just becomes like you're pushing people through.
Mm.
And, you know, it's just a line. You go up, you get your autograph, take your picture, and you move on. Maybe you say a couple things. Here you get to spend an evening and interact and watch, more importantly, three guys interact with each other. And how
true.
Their relationship works. So
pretty cool.
Cool event. I would encourage you to check it out if you're in Chicago. Otherwise, we're reaching the end of our time, but I wanted to touch on a couple of things really quickly. Demetrius Johnson did a Q&A with John Wortham on SI.com. Make sure to check that out. One of the things he said is he wants a seven-figure payday. And I know in an interview, I think he said with ESPN's Brett Okamoto that MMA is the only sport where the best athletes don't get paid the best.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting way of looking at it. You know, Joe Flacco isn't necessarily selling tickets, but he's one of the highest paid players in the league but he's got a Super Bowl, and that's why.
That's right.
So anyways, will he get it?
If he keeps pushing for it, he might, but he's got to be willing to keep pushing for it. Conor McGregor talked real big about not needing the UFC to do the Floyd Mayweather fight and looking at the law and all, and turns out no, he's just trying to work with the UFC. So if he pushes for it, I sure hope he does. I think the UFC is going to be reluctant to do it, but they're certainly calling him one of, if not the best MMA fighters of all time. Well, you know, maybe he should be paid like one of the best fighters of all time then.
And I should clarify that this wasn't direct. He was kind of being asked at the same time about a super fight at 135 pounds. So this wasn't just like he thinks his next flyweight title defense should be this. He was saying that like...
I should say that. I mean,
that's an argument can be made there as well, obviously. But
you're right. He's specifically talking about
moving back up. He wasn't saying that. And that's, I think, an important clarification.
Yeah, totally
is. His words, man. Also this weekend, Titan FC 44, Jose Shorty Torres, a Chicago guy. We did an interview with him. You can look that up. It was like an hour long. It was a great sit-down talk with him. He came into the studio. He fights this weekend for the bantamweight title on Titan FC. He, if he wins, becomes a two-weight champion. And he'll be 5-0, I think, at that point. Awesome. He's looking to get into the UFC. Do you think the UFC signs him?
If they're paying attention, if they're smart, they certainly should, because at this point they can get him cheaper than he would be, you know, if he's a few years older. And he's definitely a guy that has UFC level skills and talent. I think he's like he needs to be there eventually. They should scoop him up when they can, early as they can.
Well, I mean, you look at the flyweight picture. There's, you know, it's a division where everybody's like, oh, Demetrius Johnson cleared it out, but you have some guy contenders who've established themselves: Ray Borg, Sergio Pettis. You can't let those guys fight each other. They basically need to sit in a holding pattern and wait to take turns fighting Demetrius Johnson, assuming that he wins whichever the next fight is.
Right.
And then you're going to need somebody else. Like, why not bring in Jose Torres, who's will be 5-0, give him a couple fights, get that up to 7-0. It's a little, you know, record that might appeal to things. The other thing that people don't understand is this is a guy who's 25-1 as amateur, and I think he's on like an 18 fight win streak going back to his amateur career. Like,
he's
a world
seasoned dude.
Titles in amateur, 25-1, 26. Yeah. I mean, he's not inexperienced. He's not your average 5-0 guy, but you saw a 10-0 Chris Weidman knockout. Anderson Silva. Right. You saw a 10-0 or 11 or 12, somewhere around there. Cody Garbrandt just beat Dominic Cruz.
Right.
So,
right.
He's
no,
ready
it's
to wait.
Yeah, it's important for people to remember that. You know, it sounds like, oh, five fights, you know, that's not enough. Well, yeah, it's pretty close to enough. And on top of that, he has way more amateur fights than most MMA fighters get.
Five fights? How about 31
fights? Right, exactly.
And in that, he's 30-1. Like,
exactly. No, the kid's a stud, and he's world class for sure.
He's a good kid too. He trains out with TJ Dillashaw. TJ Dillashaw flies him in to train.
So that says a lot right there.
So,
how about that?
Yeah, exactly. TJ Dillashaw uses this guy to prepare him for fights. He told us because Dillashaw doesn't know how to not go 110%. He's one of the few people who can handle it.
Yeah, he was willing to spar with TJ. Yeah.
But that helps. This only helps. Shorty Torres, and he's out there training at Elevation Fight Team, which is a stack team. We talked to Curtis Blades. He flights out. Yeah. He came into the office. He trains out there. There's a lot of professional fighters. Kat Zingano trains there.
That's right.
So he's around the best of the best.
Yeah, absolutely. Neil Magny, Matt Brown, just tons of names. Yeah.
I was talking to him for a piece that'll run tomorrow, and he said he feels like a professional athlete finally, which was kind of
that's cool.
Thing.
That is cool.
And then the last thing I wanted to say before we hang it up. Bellator 179 in London at the Wembley Arena. I think it's renamed something else, but it was the Wembley Arena.
Always Wembley right here. Man.
Yeah. It's
forever
like a
Wembley.
Cowboy
hashtag.
Stadium. It was Cowboy Stadium for 5 years, and they tried to change it to AT&T. It'll always be Cowboy
Stadium.
That's
right. That's right.
Which is a genius move by Jerry Jones, but we'll get into that another. anyways, Rory McDonald, Paul Daly, main event, welterweight title implications. The winner will get the shot at Diego Lima or who's he fighting? Sorry. Lorenz Larkin.
That's right.
From the UFC.
That's right.
They fight at Bellator NYC. They'll get the winner of that.
Yeah.
So, predictions. Do you think Rory McDonald just comes in and starts wrecking people?
I think he's an amazing fighter. I think he's taking a lot of damage for being a young man. So, we'll see how much his reflexes have diminished. That said, his skills match up really well against someone like Semtex. I feel like Rory, if things get a little too hairy with Daly's quick and powerful punches, which they can get Harry very fast. He can knock out a mule at any given day, probably always will be able to till his dying day. If things get a little rough, he doesn't like the look he's getting from Daly on the feet. I feel like Rory McDonald could take the fight down. He's got excellent wrestling. So I think it's a good matchup. As good a matchup as really dangerous matchups go for Rory McDonald. I'll pick Rory. I think in five rounds he can get a stoppage or submission.
Daly, in his last fight, knocked out a guy in Bellator known for knocking people out, Brennan Ward. So definitely a dangerous opponent. It's going to be a good fight. Unfortunately, there's four events in MMA that night, and then Invicta the next night. It's a crazy weekend for MMA.
It's just splitting up the time zones, right? Like, at least if it's in Wembley, instead of like, you can watch it in the morning or afternoon, or is that not right?
That's a topic for another day.
All right.
But I believe it will be tape delayed.
Okay. So you are, yeah, you've got to have 16 television sets.
Unless you
can
find a Brazilian, or not Brazilian, British
yeah.
stream to
That's
watch.
That's true.
which isn't the worst idea.
No.
Then the last thing I wanted to ask is, last week it was announced that Michael Venom Page had a knee injury and he was off the card. Do you think that hurts the card?
Yeah, sure. I mean, he's a budding star and he's a British dude, so I bet it does. But for Bellator, they probably sold all the tickets they were going to sell at this point. So I think people will tune in for Daly versus McDonald. It's, you know, anytime you lose a guy like Venom Page off your card, it hurts. But I still think it's a good card and it's worth watching.
The interesting thing, I think, is the Daly-McDonald fight kind of gave something for the purists, and the MVP gave something for the casual fans.
That's true.
So for that one, I thought it was a well-rounded pair of pro main events.
Yeah, no, it's very true.
MVP brings the entertainment, these, you know, viral video sensation kind of thing coming to it. So
What's the popping and locking element? He dances a lot.
It's
upper body dancing. Upper body dancing.
him and Cody Garbrandt could have a dance off one day.
That would be good. That would be really good.
I didn't know Cody Garbrandt was such a big dancer.
Not until he did it in the middle of a freaking fight with Dominic Cruz. That was impressive.
Maybe one day we'll get Cody Garbrandt and the whole show will just us be watching UFC 207 with him and him walking us through like, so why did you decide to start dancing?
Anyways, in tutorial.
We can hope. Thank you everyone for tuning in to watch again. This concludes the show. We're going to be uploading it to iTunes, to Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, everywhere that podcasts are located. So make sure to log on and subscribe and leave a review and rate the podcast. And thank you all for listening. We will see you next week.